At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Item one, money actually has a price. Think about that for just a second. Item two, $1 billion is the least of Wells Fargo's worries. And item three, scary movies. I still don't get it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, April 23rd. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a number, a relatively simple number, but a number which brings with it meaning for everybody in this economy who has debt or plans to have debt or works for a company that has debt. The number of the day is 3. The identifier you need to have here is the word percent. 3% is the interest rate, the yield that the government's 10-year treasury note is getting really close to. In isolation, not a huge deal, but in the context of the low-rate environment that markets have gotten so used to, it is something of note. The 10-year hasn't been at 3% since January of 2014, and as I said, this is, in essence, a story about the price of money. So Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going with this look into the hype around 3%.
Crossing this 3% threshold, it's a bit like turning 30. It's not like you wake up at 30 with wrinkles and a bad back, and it's not like 3% is going to be fundamentally different for the economy than 2.9%. But
psychologically, it seems like a big deal.
Michelle Gerard is chief U.S. economist at NatWest Markets.
I don't want to suggest that the rise in yields is not giving some pause. I think people are worried that it could have an adverse impact on the economy.
That's because rising yields tend to coincide with falling stock prices. And higher yields mean higher borrowing costs on everything from mortgages to car loans, corporate borrowing too. But Gerard isn't worried.
It's actually just a very small step in a direction of travel that's been ongoing.
Colin Martin, a fixed income strategist with the Schwab Center for Financial Research, says one big reason why Treasury yields have been rising recently is because inflation is rising.
Ultimately, if you're a long-term bondholder, you want to beat inflation. So if inflation is expected to rise, you're going to see long-term yields generally rise as well.
It's natural investors would want to ask for more interest to make sure rising inflation doesn't erode their profits. But Martin is actually more focused on the positive side of higher bond yields.
We kind of like to strip it down to basics and just say this is a good thing if you're looking for higher income.
Say for retirees who often own bonds and live off their steady, predictable interest payments. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
No sooner had French President Emmanuel Macron unpacked his bags, metaphorically speaking, at Blair House in Washington today, across Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House, than he set off on foot for the National Mall and a visit to the Lincoln Memorial. Macron is making the first state visit of the Trump administration, as you've heard, and the unlikely chemistry these two men appear to have could have big implications for the global economy. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
Both men were disruptors who shook up their nation's political establishment, says Mark Fitzpatrick with the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Macron is a strong leader, and he's very much in Trump's mold of somebody who came out of nowhere to capture the French presidency.
Both have pushed pro-business reforms in their countries. Since that 30-second handshake during Trump's Bastille Day visit to Paris last year, they've touted a special relationship.
There's a lot of personal chemistry there that Macron hopes to build upon.
One of Macron's main goals will be getting Trump to extend a waiver for U.S. tariffs on European steel and aluminum, says Celia Bouillon at Brookings.
I think he needs to convince President Trump to stop the trade war with European allies.
Trump has a May 1st deadline on that decision, and by May 12th must decide whether to renew economic sanctions on Iran. Macron wants the U.S. to rejoin the nuclear deal, but Bouillon says he probably won't change Trump's mind there.
The best he can do is mitigate the fallout from this decision.
While the two men seem to get along, Paris-based fellow Nicholas Dungan at the Atlantic Council says at a deeper level, their worldviews are at odds.
As Trump pursues America first, Macron is pursuing the liberal international order that the United States created and that Trump is to a large degree dismantling.
Macron isn't the only European leader in D.C. this week. German Chancellor Angela Merkel will visit the White House Friday, but without the fanfare of a state visit. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Aaron mentioned tariffs and Macron wanting to keep France out from underneath them. There are other ways to do that, to avoid import duties, that companies have been doing for hundreds of years. One way is what's known as transshipment. Send your stuff through a third country, one that's got a friendlier trade deal, as a way of avoiding those direct tariffs. The Trump administration says it's bound and determined to stop those companies from making transshipments. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains how and how a crackdown could be a business opportunity for some logistics companies.
Companies have been trying to get around paying tariffs since the birth of international trade. But 100 years ago, lots of products were made completely in one country.
Nowadays, it's totally different. The factory floor has broken through its walls and now spans borders and oceans.
That's Dan Eikenson, director of the Cato Institute's Center for Trade Policy Studies. He says technically there's nothing illegal about shipping something from China to, say, Malaysia, modifying it and shipping it to the U.S. But because the definition of origin for a product isn't as simple as it used to be,
transshipment takes on a more nefarious meaning in the sense that it's used to circumvent duties that are in place.
And when duties or tariffs are imposed, or at least threatened, the incentive to get creative with getting it to its destination is heightened. So says Gary Horlick, an international trade lawyer in Washington.
So let's say we put a 25% tariff on Chinese steel. Well, there's a temptation to ship it into Canada, put it on a truck, relabel it. But that's customs fraud.
But customs fraud laws are on the books and easier to impose. Transshipment definition and laws are more vague, and product's origin is debatable. And, says Dan Eikenson at the Cato Institute, there's money to be made ensuring that Made in Malaysia sticker gets on your Chinese-born product.
You're going to find creative ways of changing products ever so slightly so that they have a new definition and are assessed with a different sort of tax, if at all.
Meanwhile, international trade continues to flow. U.S. Commerce and Customs Department are left scrambling, trying to catch up to tariff dodgers. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Markets today, bonds we talked about a little bit. Stocks were kind of neither here nor there. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sometimes a book title sums up the current zeitgeist pretty well, even if it's completely unintentional. The latest from economist Dambisa Moyo is called Edge of Chaos. It's an exploration of economic growth and the politics of it, what happened to that growth, and how to get it back in the long haul. It's good to have you on the program.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
I want to go to your subtitle for a second and ask you about that. Why democracy is failing to deliver economic growth and how to fix it. Start me off with why economic growth is vital, which is where you spend the first couple of chapters of this book.
Yes, so absolutely important to have economic growth. And for one thing, it's about living standards, our ability to have improvements in how we live, how we communicate, how we transport ourselves and engage with our families. The other element of it is that really the evidence shows that to have a thriving democracy, you need to have a thriving middle class that's able to hold the government accountable. And therefore, in order to have a middle class, you need to have economic growth so people can see improvements in their wages and living standards. So that's also a very important piece of why economic growth matters for poverty alleviation, but also improvements in living standards.
Okay, so make the connection for me between democracy and economic growth, because democracy, your thesis here is, has failed in our economic development.
Well, I wouldn't say it's failed. I think it's under siege right now. The critical important point is that we have a lot of macroeconomic headwinds that are impacting the global economy. Things like income inequality, issues around the amount of debt that the U.S. government, but many governments around the world are now holding, and how it's increasing over time. That means it's limiting the ability for governments to invest in infrastructure, in education, and in healthcare. All of these things mean that we have real risks around what might happen to the middle class, and therefore, we are already seeing a lot of things that show that democracy is vulnerable and is under siege.
Okay, so let me ask you about this country specifically, since you mentioned the United States and debt. We just democratically elected in this country a Congress and a president who have decided through the democratic process in Congress to greatly increase our national debt and impose more debt on future obligations. Is that bad?
Yeah, that absolutely highlights the schism between the long-term economic challenges that the global economy faces and the short-termism that's embedded in the democratic process. Politicians are heavily driven and swayed by short-term outcomes. They want to make sure that they're elected, and therefore they're pandering to the current voter with very little consideration for the long-term implications for the global economy. Government is focusing on essentially swaying and seducing us as near-term voters to win votes so that they can remain in office.
I would also say, though, that capitalism in America, specifically Wall Street and corporate profits and reporting profits to the penny every quarter, that sort of plays into that whole thesis you're saying.
You're absolutely right. Short-termism has absolutely seeped into the corporate sector as well. We are seeing increasingly very short tenures for CEOs, meaning that a lot of CEOs turn over just in around 4 years now, when it used to be 10 years back in the 1970s. That's very, very damaging for long-term strategic planning of companies. But also the investors that invest in companies have also become incredibly short-term.
So whose job is it to think long-term, right? If politicians aren't going to do it and voters aren't going to do it, whose job is it to think long-term?
Well, I mean, I would hope, and I think that as voters, we should think long-term. We should care about our children and our children's children and generations to come. It's, you know, that is the sort of backbone of America. And therefore, I think that we are the ones who have to, in a way, skew and manage the sort of agenda of politicians. Politicians are simply pandering to what voters want. And I think to the extent that voters do care about future generations, then politicians will fall in line.
Dembisa Moyo is a global economist. Her most recent book is called Edge of Chaos. Dembisa, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt scheduled to testify on Capitol Hill this week. The official title of the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee hearing is the Fiscal Year 2019 Environmental Protection Agency Budget, but given some of the press Mr. Pruitt has been getting, questions may well range far afield. Also, among the not strictly budgetary items likely to come up are some of the regulatory rollbacks and delays that Mr. Pruitt has ordered, including rules governing the use of a controversial pesticide, which is either essential or evil, depending on which side of the agriculture industry you are on. Marketplace's Scott Tong went to the Pacific Northwest to file this report.
The pesticide at the center of this is called chlorpyrifos. It's helped a broad range of crops for decades, but it's also a neurotoxin linked to low IQ babies and dead fish. At issue here is farm production versus enhanced safety in official Washington. But in the other Washington, Washington State, it's about two guys trying to make a living.
Our family farm started in 1905.
Mike Licati grows the state vegetable, the Walla Walla sweet onion. It's big, delicate, and eaten raw.
Cut up fresh tomatoes, Walla Walla sweet onions, and some cucumbers. A pretty simple salad.
Key to growing this onion is chlorpyrifos. It kills pests like the local wireworm by attacking their central nervous systems so they can't wreak plant havoc.
As that seedling develops, they just put a hole in the crop. You know, when an onion's that small, it doesn't have a lot of root development to overcome the stress of a wireworm. So
the crop dies. $1,500 an acre down the drain. Licati uses machines to spread his seeds and tiny grains of pesticide. But other farmers spray the chemical up in the air, and the wind carries it into waterways, where the salmon live. Enter tribal fisherman Michael McConville.
We are in the Columbia River Basin, just on the edge of the gorge.
At the site where his grandfather first fished.
It's about half, I would say, half the amount of fish that we catch today as we did once before.
Salmon struggle for many reasons, overfishing, dams, and water pollution.
40 years ago, I could drink the water and not have nothing happen to me. I'm afraid to touch the water nowadays.
Several salmon are now on the endangered species list. And now, because of chemicals like chlorpyrifos, a new study finds them in jeopardy.
We're talking about extinction.
Marine fisheries scientist Andrew Rosenberg is with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Salmon are particularly vulnerable because their spawning habitat is in streams in relatively shallow water, and that's the place where the chemicals concentrate when they run off from land.
But industry groups blast the study. They say it's inaccurate and it relies too much on computer models. Heather Hansen heads the industry group Washington Friends of Farms and Forests.
Because of the types of models they're using, they're coming up with results that show the impact is going to be dramatically greater than we think it really is.
The EPA chief, Scott Pruitt, said the same thing in January, and he chose not to issue new rules limiting pesticide use. Pruitt has been unapologetic about easing rules on business in general. Here he is speaking last year.
Regulators exist to give certainty to those that they regulate. Those that we regulate ought to know what's expected of them so that they can plan and allocate resources to comply.
Pruitt last year had a choice to ban chlorpyrifos outright. His scientists recommended it, but he kept it on the market. Several environmental groups suspect the decision came after lobbying from the maker of the pesticide, Dow Chemical. Dow was a top contributor to the president's inauguration. Its CEO chaired the Trump White House Manufacturing Council. Dow and the EPA declined to comment on lobbying and regulation. Back in Seattle, at the local fisherman's terminal, commercial fisherman Joel Kawahara tries to process all this.
It's inconceivable to me that there are a class of people, citizens, who feel that they are above nature and that they can continue their business as usual just because they doubt the science.
Yet for onion farmer Mike Licati, he keeps using a pesticide that he deems essential.
I understand other people make a living on salmon, and I hope that they can continue that on just as I would like to continue on, you know, the family legacy that I have.
Farmers like him and pesticide makers could get additional help from Congress. The House Farm Bill exempts pesticide makers and users from liability if they harm endangered wildlife. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, I think it's because people still want to feel, and horror movies still make us feel things.
Yes, yeah, scary things. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial down 14 points today, less than a 10%, 24,448. NASDAQ down 17 points, about a 0.25%, 71.28. The S&P 500 up just a tiny bit, less than a point, 26.70. Existing home sales grew 1.1% in March, even though there is a housing inventory crunch. So in the home buying sector, real estate database Zillow hammered up 2%. Today, loan broker LendingTree deposited about 1.5%. Since we've been talking yields and rates and all that good stuff, look at some major banks. Bank of America up nearly 0.2%. Today, Morgan Stanley gave back about 1.5%. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note nudged up at the close. It was higher than this, but at the close, 2.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. Just as you count on Marketplace for reliable, in-depth news and information, we are counting on listeners like you to invest in what we do. The more people who support Marketplace, the more we can do to raise economic intelligence across this country. You'll reap the rewards every time you listen, knowing that you're helping Marketplace make people smarter about the economy and why it matters. And don't forget, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar when you give today, thanks to a generous challenge from our friends at Candida. Now's the time, folks. Go to Marketplace.org and make a gift to become a Marketplace investor today. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The most troubled big bank in this economy detours to Des Moines, Iowa tomorrow for its annual shareholder meeting, Wells Fargo by name. Despite the temporary relocation from its home base of San Francisco, the meeting is still expected to draw protesters, especially after last weekend government regulators hit Wells with a $1 billion fine for charging thousands of customers for car insurance they didn't need and for some funny business with mortgage lending as well. And yes, $1 billion is a steep hit, but it is not the end of the story. A whole bunch of federal agencies, including the Federal Reserve, are investigating the bank, and the Fed has already done some things that are more severe than just a fine. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
It was February 2nd, 2018, Janet Yellen's last day as chair of the Federal Reserve, and she had a final message for Wells Fargo. You're in big trouble. Edward Mills is with Raymond James Financial. He says on that day, the Fed forced Wells Fargo to fire four members of its board.
This was the first time we saw the Fed actually take a step into the boardroom.
Mills says the Fed is investigating fraudulent account openings at Wells Fargo and the failure of Wells Fargo managers to stop that. The Fed has also capped Wells Fargo's growth, a frightening prospect for any company. It can't expand beyond the nearly $2 trillion in assets it held at the end of last year. And the Fed could break up Wells Fargo.
It could literally come to that.
Jerry Caprio is a former Fed economist now at Williams College. He doesn't see a Wells Fargo breakup anytime soon. Instead, he expects the Fed to keep flexing its firing muscles.
They could insist on other senior managers being fired and tell the board, if you don't remove these managers, then we're going to remove you.
Other federal regulators are reportedly investigating Wells Fargo, including the Departments of Labor and Justice. Bartlett Naylor of Public Citizen estimates there are around a half dozen federal probes of Wells Fargo now underway into things like
foreign exchange irregularities and fees for online bill payment.
Naylor says federal regulators are also looking at sales practices in Wells Fargo's wealth management division. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer. For Marketplace.
One more quick thing on this. We had Mick Mulvaney, the acting director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, one of the regulators that fined Wells that $1 billion. We had him on the program on Friday talking about why and also talking about how he sees his job running an agency he thinks has way too much power. If you missed it, it's on our Friday podcast. Subscribe, check it out, tell your friends wherever you get your podcasts. We don't usually do the weekend box office numbers on this program. Mostly they're kind of rote, right? But sometimes they can help illuminate a larger truth, which this weekend is that horror pays, and sometimes big, too. The top grossing film this past weekend was John Krasinski's The Quiet Place, a horror film that opened 2 weeks ago, I might add, and has done $130-plus million in box office on a $17 million production budget, the latest in a string of low-budget scary movies that have become word-of-mouth hits. Sean Fennessy's editor-in-chief of The Ringer, where he's been writing about the horror phenomenon. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
Where do horror films sort of stand in the pantheon of movies these days, right? Because you got your big blockbusters, and then you got these things that kind of come out of nowhere.
Yeah, they're sort of the stepchild, and they've always been the stepchild. But they're the stepchild we love.
How come? Why do we love them so much? Let me just interrupt and say I hate scary movies. I don't go see them. I don't like being scared. I don't enjoy them. I don't understand why people go see them. But we'll get to that in a minute.
I wanted
cards on the table.
That makes you rare among Americans. Horror movies, aside from the event movies you talked about, are the only movies that people consistently want to go see in theaters.
I know, which kind of makes me crazy.
It is strange.
But why do people like to go see them so much, other than enjoying the scary parts?
I think it's because people still want to feel. And horror movies still make us feel things, in groups, too. We're not just stuck in a room on our phone wondering about our shopping list or what we have to do tomorrow. We have to be locked into the experience, feeling things as a group.
And also, as you say in this piece, they're not sequels or prequels or origin stories. They're not parts of big series. You know, all of those things, right? They're sort of each, most of them anyway, elemental to themselves.
Yeah, it's true. They stand alone if they have to. And even the sequels, if you want to just walk into a sequel to a horror movie, you can basically get the gist. You don't need to know what happened in the previous horror movie. Something bad
happened.
So
there's a slasher and something scary happened and then next, right?
Exactly.
Also, I would say Hollywood probably loves them because they're just cheap to make.
That's exactly right. Get Out is a great example of that.
Yeah.
Get Out cost less than $5 million. It made over $300 million worldwide.
And with how many Oscar nominations and wins,
exactly.
You know, whatever.
It was a huge cultural moment.
Talk to me then for a minute actually about cheap movies. Jason Blum of Blumhouse, who had a hand, I guess, in Get Out as well.
He did.
And also now with the one that's out now, Truth or Dare, right?
Truth or Dare, that's right.
Yeah,
he has a very clear strategy, which is he takes small bets on big ideas, and there are strong elevator pitches with first, second, third-time filmmakers, people who aren't going to spend a lot of money, knows how to get teenagers in the movie theater, knows how to get adults like ourselves in the movie theater, and it's just low risk, high reward. And he's been able to do it 12, 14,
yeah,
16 times.
A zillion times, yeah. And I should say, by the way, for those interested in more about Jason Blum, we had him on the show as part of a panel I did at a Vanity Fair thing about a year or so ago. So, yeah, totally interesting dude.
He's brilliant. He's really smart.
Compare and contrast that, though, the Blumhouse approach with, I guess it's Paramount with A Quiet Place.
Yeah, so the Paramount approach is a little bit more traditional big movie studio. Yeah. There's a little
bit bigger
budget.
With a couple of stars, right?
Yeah, John Krasinski, who directed the film and also the star of the film, his wife, Emily Blunt, also the star of the film. This is a little bit different from what we were talking about before, that low-risk thing. Although A Quiet Place, relative to your, I don't know, your Marvel's Avengers, is still a very, very small bet for a major studio.
Yeah, totally.
But, you know, it's more of that mid-budget thing, and that also seems to have worked.
And it's also, they're also really good ways for young directors to get in, right? I mean, you look at, like, Spielberg, and some of the biggies started doing, you know, low-budget-ish horror movies.
Absolutely. And we just talked about Jordan Peele and Get Out, and who knows where his career's going. I don't think, I suspect his next five films will not all be horror films.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you go? Are you a fan?
Oh, I love them. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I live for it.
Why?
I think it's because of what I said. I really want to feel. You know, I really want to. I like
So the corollary there is I don't really want to feel. Is that where we are?
Well, it depends on what you want to feel, what those feelings are.
Sean Fennessy, editor-in-chief of The Ringer, also the podcast is called The Big Picture. Sean, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, I don't joke about this anymore because of all the trouble I got into that one time I did joke about it but didn't actually say I was kidding. But if I was going to quit this job, again, if I have found where I'm going, from the Associated Press, this item, Harley Davidson is looking for 8 summer interns. The assignment? Ride a Harley around the country for 12 weeks and write about it on social media. Also, they get paid and they get to keep the Harley at the end of the summer. I can totally do that. All right, we got to go. Forget equities. Keep your eye on bonds, people. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres, Nahili Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.